The following recording may contain explicit language. I can't get more explicit than may. Let's just say it may. It's Tuesday, January 22nd, 2019. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Iowa Senator Jody Ernst filing for divorce. At issue, Jody Ernst's husband, Gail, has apparently been stymieing his wife's career. This is from the divorce filing. It refers to the summer of 2016. In the summer of 2016, Jody Ernst writes, I was interviewed by candidate Trump to be vice president of the United States. I turned candidate Trump down, knowing it wasn't the right thing for me or my family. I continued to make sacrifices and not soar higher out of concern for Gail and our family. Now, I've got to say, I do not know the facts or details of anyone else's marriage, but if the allegation of spousal fault is that the husband did support the wife all the way to her becoming a senator, but failed to support the wife all the way to becoming the vice president to Donald Trump, that may actually be the greatest support of all. So you're saying if he were a better husband, you'd be Donald Trump's vice president? That's the knock against him for doing whatever it took? It seems like you should maybe give the guy credit for doing whatever it took by implication or overt action to impress upon you the downside of being Donald Trump's vice president. Now, let's say a neighbor's dog bit me and the bite got infected and I was supposed to fly the next day, but I couldn't fly. And that flight went down over the Pacific and lost everyone aboard. I'm not saying that I would go out and buy the neighbor's dog a supply of dog treats, but I wouldn't be calling animal control anytime soon. You certainly have to wonder about putting in the divorce filing that this is an example of my husband's failing. He prevented me from becoming the next Mike Pence. And keep in mind that unlike Mike Pence, Joni Ernst had a viable political career. She still does. She was not hated by the voters of her state at the time. Look, I don't know personally anything about the Jeff Bezos marriage, Jeff and Mackenzie Bezos, but I don't think that Jeff is going to ding Mackenzie with, oh, you know what? She was against the Amazon phone, the Amazon Fire. She said it wouldn't be a hit. But when it comes to Senator Ernst and the presidential bucket fire, I guess that is a charge. On the show today, in the spiel, my thoughts on the thoughtless teens of Covington Catholic. But first, she is a Chicago-based critic who's been writing about music since she was 16. A couple of years ago, she came out with, quote, the first collection of criticism by a living female rock critic, which is literally the name of a book and surprisingly close to literally true. She is now out with a memoir called Night Moves. In this discussion, Jessica Hopper and I talk about Jim DeRogatis, whose reporting broke the R. Kelly story. And we talk about why the Me Too movement hasn't hit the music industry as deeply as it's hit Hollywood. And of course, her memoir, Night Moves.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile Coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
Jessica Hopper was the editor-in-chief of the Pitchfork Review. She is the author of the inaccurately, she will admit to, the inaccurately named the first collection of criticism by a living female rock critic. But her new work is Night Moves, which bills itself as a memoir. I kind of think it's like just a collection of reflections, but well done and terse and poetic from the mid to late aughts. Hello, Jessica. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
How would rock change if the electric guitar were never invented? I don't know. I just want to start off with a provocation. Would it still be rock?
Oh, my gosh. Well, without the electric guitar, would we have the indelible work of Sister Rosetta Tharpe?
Mm-hmm.
Would we have everything that came after her? Where would we have gone? That's a good one. What would we be driven by?
I mean, there'd be synth and there'd be keyboards and maybe the main instrument would be a fiddle.
Maybe it'd be into harps.
Yeah. Well, I don't
know.
Some
other stringed thing because you would have to balance it. You just threw me a complete curveball.
Would the Doors be bigger than the Beatles? Would Question Mark and the Mysterians have more than one hit?
I mean, could we rewind history and just erase the Doors? That'd be fine by me.
Yeah. I'm with you.
Yeah.
Or do critics hate the Doors? Or is it like too easy an opinion?
It just
kind of,
I mean, it depends because I think they were canon for so many people, and I just don't think of them as like a terribly sophisticated band,
right?
And
which would be fine,
and they're corny. I think reading those sort of contextual things about it, it's like the idea of really how, you know, visceral and sensual and, you know, him in his leather pants. And even though he was, as Ann Powers, you know, noted in her most recent book, you know, anytime he was waving his dick around, it was limp. And so I just, you know, a very interesting sort of way to be associated with being like a very sexy rock god.
Yeah.
As a guy who's waving his limp member around being the emblem. But, you know, to me, that's as far as I'm interested.
Okay, so I do want to talk about the memoir Night Moves, which was about a specific period in your life, as all periods in one's life are.
Yeah.
The number one thing was seeing music and riding pretty bad bicycles. That defined yeah. your life, and being cold in Chicago.
Being cold, being hot. It's there's so much. As someone said, there's so much weather in your book. The book is culled from a blog I kept, from journals I kept, from fanzines I did between 2004 and 2008. And 2004 to 2008 is effectively, you know, the beginning of my professional career as a writer.
So weren't you in Minneapolis before?
I'm from Minneapolis,
right.
And so I was in
Minneapolis.
And then
you did your fanzines there as a teenager.
Yes, and yeah. I lived in L.A. for a few years and then moved to Chicago in order to really be part of that music community. And I worked with music and I wrote on the side and I did all of these things for years. And then around 2004, 2005, I decided to, you know, stop putting all this effort into supporting other people's careers and kind of put that energy into mine and start writing full time or attempting to write full time. I was also, you know, DJing bad parties and I was, you know, God, doing all sorts of dumb jobs for money. But
well, the Hold Steady said most people are critics and everyone's a DJ and you're both.
Yes.
How important was the bicycling to it?
I didn't actually get a license, I think, until I was like 23. And so I had just been somebody who was always on my bike or on the bus. And so finally I got a car when I lived there. But still, the car felt like weirdly unnatural. But my favorite place to listen to music is in the car. That is my place where I commune with records. If I'm reviewing a record, I got to listen to it at least four times in the car.
Yeah, it's important too. I don't want to do the thing where I just read you back to you, but I want to ask about a couple phrases. Hold on,
okay.
I put them on the phone. Alas, I returned home, keyed and bedraggled, and realized I could have ridden my bike, and I needn't have gone into the hall looking for the cat in the first place, as he was trapped in the closet. And then you were talking about a security guard at the library you were working with and said, I have a neutral fascination with him. I just was underlining different phrases and wondering, are you using this, like, without thinking, is that you're writing for yourself. It's a diary. It's you never intend for anyone to read it.
Well, my blog was called Tiny Lucky Genius, aka the Unicorn's Tear, and back then the internet operated in a different way. It was much more of a sort of, or at least we believed, much more cloistered space. And you wouldn't have been reading my blog probably if you didn't know me or maybe had read my fanzine or kind of at least knew me socially or cared about the same bands or, you know, I'd make these little fanzines. I was like 200 people maybe bought them on a tour with a band that I was in or something like that, you know? It was essentially private. It was on a closed circuit. It was a cloister of people who gave that kind of shit about punk rock.
So the Jessica Hopper of today doesn't have the message instilled in her that this isn't a place for women. There are definitely women who could do rock criticism and write about all sorts of music. But at the same time, you also had this, it worked out that you were able to do it without so much scrutiny, right? You could write your fanzine, you could write your zines, and it's not like it was going to be jumped on by Twitter mobs. Is it better or worse for, well, you tell me.
Well, it was different.
Yes.
It was different. People would write me letters or people would try to fight me at the hardcore show or people would beef with you via their column in a different fanzine or, you know, it was just, it was, the mechanics were different, though it wasn't so fast moving or virulent. My forever joke about this, but it's true, is that if people were really pissed, they'd use both sides of the paper, you know, of the letter that they sent me.
You could tell by how hard they pressed their pen into it.
Yeah.
The passion. Yeah.
Yeah. And I crave a more analog life generally, but all of this is to say is that my experience has been just that the reaction to me being initially a teenage girl with opinions to being a grown-ass woman, you know, as far as I know, I'm one of, you know, a handful of women in their 40s writing about music still. It's different. It's different the way that people come after you about it.
Do you think, I was reading a roundtable of people in the music industry saying that our industry, the music industry, is lagging behind the reckoning we're seeing in other forms of entertainment.
Oh, absolutely.
And why?
I mean, I think it's really, it's complicated. And I think I have a slightly skewed sense of it. After Harvey Weinstein, you know, came to light, around that time and in the months that followed, all of a sudden I heard from publications I had never written for, publications I would have loved to write for. And everyone was coming to me saying, who's the Harvey Weinstein in music? Surely you must know. Come on, let's like take him down. And, you know, I had over the previous decade, probably 6-7 stories that I had tried to report and couldn't be reported for various reasons. Anybody who's worked within that end of journalism knows it's really hard, and it's still really hard that there's certain bars that you have to clear in order to be able to report on
sexual assault. Before Ronan had the story in The New Yorker, Ken Auletta had it all but buttoned up, and they wouldn't go to press with it because it has to be perfect, and you could have one strand of it that isn't, and someone like that isn't nailed down, and then Harvey Weinstein will destroy you.
And even you know, when the 17 months that we were at MTV News, we actually had that last big Jim De Regatta story was with us for 4.5 months, and there were reasons that were basically kind of almost strangely procedural that we couldn't. There was a certain bar that we couldn't clear, despite having also multiple people on the story with Jim, and it was, you know, it wound up running at BuzzFeed in an abbreviated form, but at one point we had, you know, 14,000 words with it at MTV News, and some of these stories are so labyrinthine. But anyway, so all these publications were coming to me going, surely you must have somebody. But one of the things that really, as I started to talk to people, I kept finding, and this is no shade on these publications, you know, all of them were quite reputable. They all just wanted a big name and they wanted it to be a kill shot.
Mm-hmm.
All the things that I had, none of them were people who'd ever pressed charges. Some of them were people who also had consensual relationships with people who then sexually assaulted them or vice versa. You know, some of these things that we kind of see that are complicated. And I wanted to report these things that were much more gray areas. People just wanted one person. They wanted it to be famous. They wanted it to be conspiratorial. They wanted a music's Harvey Weinstein. No one wanted the complicated stories. No one wanted stories with gray area. Or people are like, well, that band's too small. And it's like, well, it still matters.
The victim's the victim.
These people have survived the same thing.
And could I just pause and ask you this question? Yeah. So with the Harvey Weinstein story, you know, Ronan had it at MSNBC or NBC, but NBC had interests broadly defined with Weinstein. Now, it strikes me as not coincidental that The New Yorker, which isn't doing any business with Weinstein, is the publication to break it. Maybe a music publication always, you know, they work hand in glove with a lot of artists.
I mean, the other thing about some of the people I know who have come to me and other journalists with these stories, they only want to talk to women. And then there's some women I know at publications who aren't allowed to write about this stuff because the editor goes, you care too much. You're too close to it. You're too invested. You're not skeptical enough of these women because you believe them. And they think that's unjournalistic. I mean, it's so many different things. And then it is also, you know, my experience of not being able to get some of these stories through. It's because they were at publications who said, this person, this thing, this operation, this whatever it's associated with is too big. They have too much money, basically, too big to go after, not worth the risk.
What am I imagining this? Did you say about seven stories that you knew something about, let's say?
Yeah.
How many of those in some form have come to light?
None.
Really? Do you think for others in the music industry to get some version of a reckoning as R. Kelly is getting, does every future R. Kelly need their future Jim DeRogatis? One person who will steadfastly hunt that down, perhaps at great professional and personal cost?
I mean, that's kind of the baffling thing, is because how hard Jim and other people have had to work for years to convince people, to get people to care about R. Kelly in particular. I mean, God, I hope it's not a matter of that. I don't know. It's something I think about so much. You know, but I think anybody who knows a fair amount of these stories knows just how endemic it is to music historically.
Mm-hmm.
And that once the ball starts rolling. I mean, the ball has started rolling. And the thing is lots of times it's been smaller stories. You know, people who aren't Pitchfork news level bands. And so there are things that are happening on smaller levels. And so I think it's a little unfair for people to go, well, where's the reckoning? Well, the reckoning is happening everywhere because everyone's talking about it and everyone's thinking about it. And I don't think there's like one right way for this to happen, where it's like a lightning bolt strikes, like how it's happened with, you know, these Hollywood level stars, in part because I think people who are in smaller music scenes, people have a lot to lose and almost nothing to gain.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Jessica Hopper is the author of The New Night Moves and is a, you know, I'm going to say fairly extremely important voice in the last 20 years of music writing and criticism. Jessica, great to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where it got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying, unflattering things about the war effort and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel. Indifference in the face of injustice is bad, but uncertainty in the face of ambivalence is not. The rowdy teens of Covington Catholic versus the stoic drumming of Native American activist Nathan Phillips would be a perfect Rorschach test if you allow for an ink blot that dons a MAGA hat. So Magorshak. Perhaps you spent hours of careful analysis, or perhaps you clicked two tweets and decided that the irresponsible teens of Covington Catholic were horrible louts, that they were emblematic of privilege and power. Or perhaps you've since concluded that though they're somewhat disrespectful dumbasses, they didn't realize their poses would so provoke. Either way, you would be hard-pressed to concoct a more potent example of the fault lines of American society if you'd contracted with a den of fancy bear operatives to assist you. As good as the Russians have become at inflaming America, they have nothing on Americans ourselves. The confrontation at the Lincoln Memorial plunged a finger into the most sensitive nerve within the cavity that has become the national discourse. It had everything. Trump, white kids, a Native American elder, black cultists in the background screaming anti-gay invective, abortion, remember, they were there for the pro-life march, and forensic videography. The only way it could have been more polarizing would be if the original footage were pulled off Anthony Weiner's hard drive. Now, as for the videography, that's really what Americans love. Almost 40 years ago, the critic George Trow wrote about the context of no context. Now, this was a pre-CNN, let alone pre-Twitter, Snapchat, WhatsApp world. But the idea of the trivial being mistaken for the profound and vice versa obtains. Americans love nothing more than seeing some footage and debating and contemplating or hastily deciding what that means. In fact, the AFC Championship game this past Sunday drew more viewers than any TV show since last year's Super Bowl. And the game was an exercise in viewing and reviewing plays on videotape. Ratings went up as we paused to examine 8, 10, 12 times whether a bouncing ball did or didn't scrape a fingertip of Julian Edelman. And if you want a referendum on whether Americans take offense at red-hatted white people taking little care with the traditions of Native Americans, this is 76,000 people at Kansas City's Arrowhead Stadium. The tomahawk chop and the attendant chant is set off when a Kansas City Chiefs player beats a faux ceremonial giant war drum. But so many of us have decided that the boisterous teens of Covington Catholic acted not just abhorrently, but aberrantly. To those who saw the original video as an affront, the MAGA hat was very triggering and not without reason. One of the defenses of the foolish teens of Covington Catholic was, though they were accused of shouting, "Build the wall," there's no evidence or video of them actually shouting, "Build the wall." By the way, that's remarkable. Think about this. Build the wall is the signature proposal of the President of the United States. It is the issue animating the most pressing short-term dispute in America today, the shutdown. It is also used, unquestioningly, and correctly, by the way, as shorthand for racial animus, for fighting words. Every conservative commentator who came to the defense of the odious teens of Covington Catholic cited as defense exhibit A or B that those teens never said build the wall. So get this, the absence of vocally endorsing the president's platform by name is cited as exculpatory, often by the very same people who think that building a wall is the right policy. Ben Shapiro is such a commentator. I checked in with his show, as I do, to get a sense of where the right was in describing the confrontation. And Shapiro was spitting mad, but also spitting ads.
If you're not willing to call out lies, then you are not doing your job as a journalist. Speak truth to power. Democracy dies in darkness. All these media liars. I'll get to that in just 1 second. First, we need to talk about how you can save time and money. Here's an easy way to save time and money and to cool down right now. Go online shopping. And when you do, make sure that you use Honey. You've probably heard me talk about Honey. It's the free, amazing browser edition extension.
Time and time again, Shapiro got to a breaking point of disgust at the sheer injustice of it all, only to be redirected at the last minute by an ad read. And then there was talk of Nick Sandman, the high school junior who smirked. Definition of smirk, smiling while MAGA. Ben Shapiro began to read Sandman's professional PR firm coded statement, but again, the commercial imperative intervened.
I was thankful nothing physical had happened. In a second, I'm going to read you the rest of the student's statement. But first, I need to tell you about life insurance. So here's the reality. We're all going to plot, and when we plot, we're going to want to make sure that our family had some money.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to tell you there is a rot in our body politic, and I never thought I would say it. But the name of this rot is Skittles Candy, available in 7 exciting fruit flavors. Grab the rainbow as I grab for a copy of the Constitution. Because this document, which I keep close to my breast pocket, has the answers. It is all we need to beat back these dark forces that threaten us from within and without, these instincts that are tearing us apart that cannot be reassembled except with craftsman tools. Flex claw hammer, a rotating head converts into a pry bar for 2 tools in one. To Shapiro and Laura Ingraham and Donald Trump, the disrespectful teens of Covington Catholic are victims or heroes. Their heroism laying mostly in the fact that they caused the libs to own themselves. To Laura Wagner, writing in The Concourse, the news organizations that pulled back on their initial assessments are, quote, performing reasonableness. Now, how would that differ from actual reasonableness? It seems reasonable, and I use the word in the non-pejorative sense, which I just found out existed. So it seems reasonable to acknowledge that the more we saw, the more we should place these regrettable teens of Covington Catholic somewhere between the buffoonish and insensitive continuum, as opposed to between the cruel or evil side of the ledger. It may seem like I'm doing that thing where I decry the divisiveness, where I'm asking us all to heal. That is what we call a platitude. That's often an argument employed after, say, a mass shooting to short-circuit the necessary discussions, including sometimes a contemplation of a new law or a norm that could serve to advance us all. But that is not what's going on in this case. If we never saw this video, all of the people in the video would be going on with their lives today largely unaffected. I don't think the petty mockery of the ill-mannered teens of Covington Catholic would sear itself onto the conscience of Nathan Phillips for years or even days to come. He would probably say something like, "What a bunch of jerks," and then he'd have moved on. We have, as a country, expelled so much angst, so much societal souris over an ambivalent and, let's say, ignorant and rude act. The Russians know us well. They're so good at exploiting our fissures because we jump right to the most extreme emotions over such a wide range of, at worst, irksome acts. The bothersome teens of Covington Catholic aren't heroes or horrors. They're not victims or unambiguous villains. They're symptoms of this fever that's becoming a pandemic. And that's it for today's show. Pierre Bien-Aimé is citing in the divorce papers with fellow GIST producer Daniel Schrader the fact that Daniel stymied Pierre's interests in the side project where I scat sing over a backing track by Blackstreet. TJ Raphael, senior producer of Slate Podcast, tried to intervene in the Daniel-Pierre spat with one simple declaration. It was no, just no, diggity. The GIST, I continue to not soar higher out of my concern for Gail Ernst and also this thing that Daedalus once told me. Umpru depru du peru, and thanks for listening.